Good morning to you all. I send warm greetings to each and every one of you, wherever you are. I am so glad that you have come to participate in our Zoom worship. Several of us are here as worship leaders. I appreciate having you all in here. Last Sunday morning, the test result came out, Judy is COVID positive, and she's been resting at home, and she's already feeling better. Judy will be off for the whole month of December, and Calvin, as you see him play last Sunday and today, Calvin is going to fill in for her. So thank you, Calvin, for coming over and playing for us. So prayers for Judy. And I have one good news to share. I had a COVID test on Thursday. The test came out negative. So I'm happy about sharing that with you, but you never know. I can be asymptomatic. So I would like to encourage you to go and have this test. I don't know whether they're still poked through the nose or not, but the test I had was getting the sample of saliva. So that was pretty easy. And it was done, but other than the waiting in line, about 3 minutes, and then the test result comes out, within less than a day. So I pray that you are continuing to be strong and doing all the measures to protect yourself. I even heard that somebody got this COVID standing like 20 feet away, so we need to always be cautious about how we go around and then how we can continue to protect ourselves. When her daughters were very small girls, Mrs. Dwight Morrow gave a high tea at which one of the guests was to be the senior J.P. Morgan. The girls were to be brought in, introduced, and ushered out. Mrs. Morrow's great fear was the possibility that Anne, the most outspoken of them, might comment audibly upon Mr. Morgan's celebrated and conspicuous nose. She therefore took pains beforehand to explain to Anne that personal observations were impolite and cautioned her especially against making any comment about Mr. Morgan's nose, no matter what she might think of it. When the moment came and the child was brought in, Mrs. Morrow held her breath as she saw Anne's gaze fixed upon the banker's most prominent facial feature and remain there. Nonetheless, the introduction was made without incident. The little girls curtsied politely and were sent on their way. With a sign of relief, Mrs. Morrow turned back to her duties as hostess and inquired of her guest, "And now, Mr. Morgan, will you have cream or lemon in your nose?" Sins find way out. Sometimes we lose control over its power. This phenomenon is called the original sin, which is transmitted from one generation to another. Every descendant of Adam and Eve is inherited with it and live under its influence. You may not have read the first chapter of Matthew from this perspective, but it, in a way, demonstrates the chains of history of sin. With this in mind, let us reflect upon why the gospel, according to Matthew, begins with the genealogy of Jesus. Just reading one name after another for almost the whole chapter could bore its readers. Judy apparently had a little tough time just reading it. The genealogy makes a little sense if you do not know life stories behind the names. Of course, there are some prominent figures, and Matthew gives a kind of title to it on verse 1. The genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Maybe those two names would have been sufficient enough, and Matthew could have moved on to the story of Christmas without further ado. But he articulates every generation from Abraham all the way to Jesus. What was his intention? This morning we are going to find out what message with the genealogy Matthew intends to convey for his readers. Comparison between Mark's genealogy and Luke's genealogy could help distinguish the unique character of Matthew's genealogy. The genealogy in Luke's gospel traces the lineage of Mary instead of Joseph. Both Joseph and Mary are descendants of the King David. So either way, Jesus is a descendant of David and fulfills the prophecy in that regard. What stands out in Matthew is that it includes names of women, while Luke includes names of male only, except Mary. Matthew includes five women: Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, and Mary. Mary is distinctive from those ladies because Mary carries the Messiah by the Holy Spirit. So there is a biological disconnection there. And I'm going to skip Mary and go over the rest. First, Rahab was a prostitute from Jericho. When Joshua sent out two spies to scout the promised land, they were chased by the natives. Rahab hid and helped the spies escape safely. When Israel invaded Jericho afterwards, she and her families were spared. Ruth was a Moabite. She first married Naomi's son. Naomi's husband and her son died, and the two widows, Naomi and Ruth, came back to Bethlehem. Ruth married Rahab's son, Boaz, and gave birth to Obed, who was the grandfather of the King David. Bathsheba was Uriah's wife. Uriah was a Hittite, and I assume that Bathsheba was a Hittite as well. David unlawfully took Bathsheba and impregnated her. David wanted to hide his crime, but Uriah was so faithful to David and would not go home and sleep with Bathsheba. So David sent Uriah to the fiercest battle to kill him. Bathsheba gave birth to Solomon. Out of all these human dramas, the story of Tamar was probably the most extraordinary. Judah was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. He left his house and married a daughter of a Canaanite woman named Shua, who gave birth to three sons, Er, Onan, and Shelah. Judah found the wife, Tamar, for his first son, Er, but Er died without any kids. By Mosaic law, a remaining brother was supposed to marry his brother's wife. A purpose of the law was to protect and provide for widows in a society where role of male was so essential that having a male in the family was almost like having a social security. So Onan married Tama, but refused to fulfill his duty as husband. His behavior was regarded wicked to the Lord, and he also died. Now Judah had only one son, Shelah, left. He was still young, and Judah was afraid of losing him. Judah told Tamar to go back to her father's house and wait there until Shelah reached his adulthood. Many years passed, and Shelah grew to be an adult. But Judah was fearful of losing Shelah and did not send for Tamar. In the meanwhile, Shuah, Judah's wife, died. One day, Tamar was told that her father-in-law was on his way to her town. So she took off her widow's clothes and covered herself with veil and waited for Judah to pass by. As Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute. He slept with her and gave her promissory notes of his seal, his cord, and his staff, which were to be given back to him when he paid her later. Judah sent a young goat through his friend, but he could not find Tamar and thought that it was the end of the deal. Few months went by, and Judah heard that his daughter-in-law became pregnant on her apparent guilt of prostitution. At her stake of being burned to death, Tamar sent a message to Judah saying, "I am pregnant by a man who owns these. See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are." Judah finally realized the wrong he did and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I would not give her to my son Shelah." Tamar thus gave birth to twin boys, Perez and Zerah, through Judah. Matthew did not go into all these details, but simply wrote, "Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar." If producers in Hollywood would create a program with this story of Judah, it would certainly be X-rated without a doubt. Isn't it amazing that Judah and Perez were chosen to carry the ancestry of the Messiah in spite of the quite unconventional life? There is more. Judah was the fourth child of Jacob, not the first. The first child of Reuben was Reuben, but Reuben might have lost his birthright because he slept with Bilhah, one of his father's wives, and his two brothers' mother. The birthright went from Reuben to Joseph, which was very understandable, for Joseph saved his family when there was a severe famine in Israel. So Joseph had more qualification to be in the lineage of Messiah than Joseph had. However, the lineage of the Messiah was traced through Judah. Is the lineage of Judah morally qualified to be a showcase for the Messiah? Not at all. I mean, if you remember the one of the Mosaic law, the intermarriage between Israelis and non-Israeli were prohibited, but you know, Judah married this Canaanite woman, and then Judah produced these twin boys through Tamar, who was not an Israeli. But they carried the prestigious lineage of the Messiah. Now it gets more remarkable. We are familiar with this prophecy in Micah 5. He prophesied the place of the Messiah's birth and said, "You, Bethlehem and Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." The Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem of Judah. The genealogy implies a very profound truth about Bethlehem as the birthplace of the Messiah. Let me explain. You know where Boaz was from? The one who married Ruth? From Bethlehem. Which hints at his father and mother, Salmon and Rahab. And they lived in Bethlehem. It also indicates that Boaz and Ruth had a family in Bethlehem after they married. Judah's lineage goes down to King David, which was one reason Bethlehem became David's hometown. Even though Bathsheba did not give birth to Solomon in Bethlehem, it was David's hometown, so it would have been Solomon's naturally. When Canaan was divided and allotted to 12 tribes of Jacob, Judah, by the divine providence, was given the southern land, which includes Bethlehem. After the nation of Israel was split into two, Judah became the southern kingdom. So the name Bethlehem and Judah go hand in hand. Now consider all the dramas happen around the town of Bethlehem. The town could be called a center of a human drama of sin. Today's term, Hollywood. The genealogy of the Messiah circle around the human sinfulness in the town with the multitude of sinful history. So what is the message that Matthew's genealogy and Christ's birth in Bethlehem convey? In spite of sinfulness, God so loved the world and sent his Son to the very center of human sinfulness to forgive sins. The Apostle Paul put this in his own word and said in 2 Corinthians 5, "God made Jesus, who had no sin, to be sin for us." Joseph Damien was a 19th century missionary who ministered to people with leprosy on the island of Molokai, Hawaii. Those suffering grew to love him and revered the sacrificial life he lived out before them. One morning before Damien was to lead daily worship, he was pouring some hot water into a cup when the water swelled out and fell onto his bare foot. It took him a moment to realize that he had not felt any sensation. Gripped by the sudden fear of what this could mean, he poured more hot water on the same spot. No feeling whatsoever. Damien immediately knew what had happened. As he walked tearfully to deliver his sermon, no one at first noticed the difference in his opening line. He normally began every sermon with, "My fellow believers," but this morning he began with, "My fellow lepers." In spite of the sinfulness in the world, the Holy God came down to the very center of a human sin to be one of us and bore our sin. So, what happened in Bethlehem? In Bethlehem, life was transformed. A prostitute began a new life. A heathen was converted. Sinners were included in the lineage of the Messiah. Sometimes we may feel like living in Bethlehem, the most humble and humiliating place, the most undeserving places in our life. Life is broken. Life is in chaos. As we look at the whole world today, this world has become Bethlehem with a health crisis. We may feel that we do not deserve God in our Bethlehems. But in spite of the unworthiness, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Jesus comes to be at the places which seem humanly impossible for God to be there. Let us look carefully inside our Bethlehems and find Christ there. Amen.